I've encountered people who have said, I just can't live this way with this fear.
On the record, Catholic bishops, cardinals, and the Pope criticize the Trump White House policy on mass deportations. The White House border czar pushes back with a sharp response. The Order of Love. U.S. politics brings a 4th century saint back in the spotlight. Our senior Vatican analyst on comments from J.D. Vance and how that squares with the teachings of St. Augustine.
My mom's going to be 96 in a couple of weeks, and I just didn't think, she didn't think that she was going to make it.
An elderly mother and her Catholic family rejoice. Their son and brother released and back in their arms after nearly 4 years in a Russian prison.
I never sat on a bench and thought that I was above anybody else, or that I was superior to them in any way, or that I never prejudged anybody.
And correspondent Colin Flynn interviews TV judge Frank Caprio about how his Catholic faith informed his courtroom rulings. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I don't get how this works for the Pope. Pope wants to fix the Catholic Church. I'm saying this as a lifelong Catholic. I was baptized Catholic. I was First Communion is a Catholic. Confirmation is a Catholic.
The Pope and the White House mix it up in pointed exchanges over immigration. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Mark Irons, sitting in this week for Catherine Hadro. In an unprecedented letter this week, Pope Francis made unusually pointed remarks for the Vatican against a particular policy of a particular country, condemning the mass deportations of the Trump administration and the notion that by just being in the U.S. illegally, a person is a criminal. In the letter to America's Catholic bishops released the day before his general audience, the Pope said he had been closely following what he called the major crisis happening in the U.S. with the initiation of the mass deportation program. The Pope acknowledged a nation's right to defend itself, have orderly immigration, and keep communities safe from those who have committed violent or serious crimes. Yet, he said the act of deporting people who in many cases have left their own land because of extreme poverty, exploitation, or persecution damages human dignity and makes those people vulnerable and defenseless. He wrote, "What is built on the basis of force and not on the truth about the equal dignity of every human being begins badly and will end badly. I exhort all the faithful of the Catholic Church and all men and women of goodwill not to give in to narratives that discriminate against and cause unnecessary suffering to our migrant and refugee brothers and sisters." At the White House, there was immediate pushback from President Trump's border czar.
He ought to fix the Catholic Church and concentrate on his work and leave border enforcement to us. He wants to attack us from securing our border. He's got a wall around the Vatican, does he not? So he's got a wall around to protect his people and himself, but we can't have a wall around the United States. So I wish he'd stick to the Catholic Church and fix that and leave border enforcement to us.
The papal letter prompted an immediate response to the Pope from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Writes USCCB President Archbishop Timothy Broglio, "As successor to St. Peter, you call not only every Catholic, but every Christian to what unites us in faith, offering the hope of Jesus Christ to every person, citizen, and immigrant alike." Broglio writes, "I ask for your continued prayers so that we may find the courage as a nation to build a more humane system of immigration, one that protects our communities while safeguarding the dignity of all." That thought further emphasized by the chairman of the USCCB's Migration Committee.
We see it as our responsibility as Christians, much less as leaders in the church, to care for the most vulnerable and for the poor. That's practically the definition of what should be the sign of Christian love.
While this exchange took place, the Holy Father nursed a case of bronchitis. On Friday after his audiences, he was admitted to the hospital for treatment with a mild fever. He's been dealing with a respiratory infection for more than a week, and it often prevented him from reading his own speeches and homilies. Please join us in praying for his health. And another major aspect of Trump's full court press on immigration is his attempt to limit birthright citizenship. His executive order has sparked even more debate on the rights of migrants and the rights of their unborn babies.
When an unborn baby is born in the United States, he or she automatically becomes a citizen. That fact is based on a legal principle known as birthright citizenship.
Essentially, what that means is that anyone who's born in the U.S. is deemed to be a citizen regardless of the immigration status of their parents.
In the U.S., birthright citizenship is founded on the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Before the creation of that amendment, if you were black in America, you weren't considered a citizen. Stacy Bruston is the director of the Immigration Law and Policy Initiative at the Catholic University of America.
The 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868 after the Civil War, was really a response to say, no, that's not who we are as a country. Everyone who is born here, including slaves, descendants of slaves, are citizens. And so that concept has endured.
Bruston says the U.S. Supreme Court has clarified birthright citizenship belongs to all people. Even so, debate over the meaning and interpretation of the 14th Amendment has endured as well, especially as immigration continues to be a hot-button issue. Critics, including some Republicans on Capitol Hill, say unrestricted birthright citizenship was never the intent.
Here's the truth. The 14th Amendment was never intended to serve as a blank check for illegal immigration. It was never intended to grant citizenship to the children of people who broke our laws to get in this in the first place.
That idea has the backing of President Donald Trump.
That's a good one. Birthright.
Soon after his inauguration, he signed an executive order to end birthright citizenship as it's currently recognized in the U.S.
People have wanted to do this for decades.
His executive order asserts that children of non-citizens are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and thus are not to be given citizenship. Federal judges have blocked the president's executive order, calling it unconstitutional, and some states' attorneys general have also pushed back.
We have sued President Trump for taking action to end birthright citizenship, but newborn babies are not criminals. This order targets innocent newborns that have done absolutely nothing wrong.
It could take years, but it's possible drawn-out litigation over birthright citizenship could bring the issue back before the Supreme Court again. More than 20 years ago, U.S. bishops addressed the issue. Family unity also is weakened when the children of immigrants are left unprotected. In the United States, birthright citizenship should be maintained as an important principle in U.S. immigration law. Bruston agrees. She says removing it could hurt children.
It would deprive them of the ability to really thrive in their communities and reach their full potential because they may be restricted in terms of public benefits or educational access or other things that citizens are eligible for.
Questions raised around the 14th Amendment not only cause people to ask who is a citizen, but also who is a person. The concerns over losing birthright citizenship caused the New York Times to use this headline, "Undocumented women ask, will my unborn child be a citizen?"
That was an extraordinary headline when the New York Times for years has said, when is a fetus a person? What does it mean to be a preborn life? I mean, they have denied the humanity of life in the womb for decades.
Pro-life advocate Christy Hamrick, vice president of media and policy for Students for Life of America, says her organization isn't taking a public position on birthright citizenship, but she hopes any debate over the issue will cause people to acknowledge all life begins not with birth or citizenship, but in the womb.
We hope that this is an aha moment for the left to say and suddenly recognize, oh my gosh, it's human beings in the womb. How are we going to protect these children?
Joining us now to continue the discussion is Paul Hunker. He's a partner in a Dallas law firm specializing in immigration law. He also served as the chief counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Dallas for more than 20 years. And Paul, I know your Catholic faith is also very important to you as you consider this issue. I just want to set this up a little bit. In your previous job, you worked for ICE, so you know the need to protect the borders. You had to make decisions about deporting immigrants. Now you're defending immigrants in your current job. Tell us a little bit more about how the Catholic faith has informed your thinking about immigration enforcement and policy.
Thank you, Mark. A lot of the decisions we would have to make in working for ICE is sort of weighing whether a non-citizen should be allowed to stay in the United States. Perhaps the person is here illegally. Perhaps the person committed a crime. And then we have to make a decision with the immigration judge making the final decision often whether the person gets to get their green card and stay here. And my Catholic faith in part related to this in that it helped me appreciate the importance of family ties. So if a non-citizen has maybe he has a crime that he committed a number of years ago, but he has a number of family members, if that person gets removed from the country, that's going to harm his family. So that appreciating the importance of the family and how important a mother is or a father is sort of helped me make some of those calls. Additionally, a lot of what I did when I was the chief counsel was decide whether we should dismiss a case or not proceed against a non-citizen. Perhaps under the law, they were removable from the country, but under principles of equity and prosecutorial discretion, we don't have to remove that person. And looking at their family, looking at their life, that the impact of their family, that was a very significant factor. Also, the sense of rehabilitation and the fact that people make mistakes and they can overcome those mistakes, and looking at the person's life and making those calls, my Catholic faith was critical for me.
Well, let's talk about President Trump's executive order. It's currently blocked, the one on birthright citizenship.
Yes.
But say it went through, how would ending birthright citizenship impact immigration into the U.S.? I mean, do you think it would stop the flow of illegal immigration?
Well, I think the argument is that it would deter people from coming because their children wouldn't be citizens, but if it would deter someone who's undocumented from coming because their children would not be citizens. But I think that's short-sighted. You know, people are coming here to make a better life for their family. They're fleeing persecution. They're fleeing poverty. And that's principally why they're coming. Creating a situation where their children are not, or who were born here are not citizens, would cause a lot of harm to those children, and I don't think it would deter people from coming.
And talking again about the executive order, we know four federal judges right now have blocked that executive order on birthright citizenship. Where do you see this going legally? Where will this battle go, and will it make it back up to the Supreme Court?
Oh, it's 100% illegal, the executive order. It's clear under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution that if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States, other than in some very narrow circumstances. It's possible it could go to the Supreme Court. It's possible the Supreme Court won't consider it, because I think all the circuit judges, all the appellate judges, whether it's a conservative court like the Fifth Circuit or a liberal court like the Ninth Circuit, are going to agree that this is illegal. So I'm not sure it will get to the Supreme Court. It may stop at the appellate courts.
Mm. Now, let's just talk about some of the people involved. I mean, when we talk about birthright citizenship, it does impact pregnant women and their unborn babies. How do you process that as a Catholic?
So I thought about that. And, you know, as Catholics, as pro-lifers, we want to create a world that is most welcoming for women and their babies, especially unintended pregnancies. We want to create a world that welcomes that baby and supports that mother. And I could see if a woman thinks that child is not going to be a citizen, that's one more negative factor that makes it harder for her to want to keep that child. Mm-hmm. So I think that birthright citizenship, which is the law, which is not going to change, is a pro-life aspect to our law.
Mm. Something to consider. Well, looking at immigration more broadly, I mean, you have seen this issue play out. Do immigrants come to the country? Are they making legitimate asylum claims from what you're seeing? Are many of them abusing the system?
I think many are making legitimate claims. Obviously, when I was a government lawyer, we would see some claims that were abusive, but many people are making legitimate claims. I think, look, many people may at the end of the day be denied asylum, but under immigration law, they have a right to apply for it. Our country makes it clear that people that are here can assert whether they fear persecution on account of their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion. And what's important is that we have a process that can adjudicate those claims quickly, and those who are entitled to them should get asylum, and those who are not should typically be required to leave the country. So it's not so much a problem that there are fraudulent claims. There are fraudulent claims. The problem is our process does not lead to a quick adjudication of claims.
And I know you really consider this issue through Catholic social doctrine. If the church spends time helping millions of migrants, are we ignoring other people in need in our country? I mean, there are many people in need, Paul.
And as we know, the Catholic Church in so many ways helps so many different people. You look at all the good that Catholic Charities does in so many ways. And the reality is, you know, people are here. Whether they're citizens of the United States or not, they're here and they're needy. And that's our responsibility to help them. I was really moved by the Pope's recent letter to the U.S. bishops on immigration. And then we need to look at these matters from the perspective of the story of the Good Samaritan, and that it helps our country that we help people who are needy sort of acclimate and come into our society. That's a good thing for our country. So it's not like we're not able to help U.S. citizens because we're helping non-citizens. We're helping everybody. We should help everybody.
What did you take away from the Pope's letter mainly? What stood out to you? And I also want to ask at the same time, you're not saying that we shouldn't be enforcing border policy or protecting the country.
We should be enforcing the laws. What the Trump administration is doing, which is a violation of human dignity, which the Pope points out in his letter, is taking away people's fundamental rights or purporting to take away fundamental rights. For example, saying that a child born here may not be a citizen, or denying people basic due process when they're apprehended on the border, not giving them a right to assert that they fear harm. That's a violation. Other things that moved me about the Pope's letter, I think I was very moved by his discussion of, you know, the incarnation, and that Jesus came into the world and sort of supernaturalized human realities. And one of those realities was he and his mother and father had to flee because of persecution. So he entered that world, and that is so much part of our world. So many people are fleeing conditions. That was very moving for me.
Thank you so much, Paul Hunker, for sharing your perspectives. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
27 Christian and Jewish groups filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration this week over its immigration policy. The lawsuit concerns Trump's repealing of a Biden-era guideline that largely prevented ICE agents from arresting people near sensitive locations like churches, hospitals, and schools. The religious communities include the Mennonite Church, Episcopal Church, and the Rabbinical Assembly. The group says the new policy has discouraged congregants from attending services and infringes on their freedom of religion and the ability to minister to migrants.
It's a basic constitutional right to have free exercise of religion. And if people are afraid to come to church, that's a problem. Our faith requires us to welcome the stranger. We're not commenting on immigration policy as much as we're saying you can't target churches.
This is the second group of religious communities to sue Trump over his policy. The plaintiffs in this new lawsuit represent more than 5 million Americans. Still to come on EWTN News in Depth, the Pope, the Bishop, and the White House border czar were not the only ones who went on the record this week with pointed remarks about the immigration debate.
That our obligation, not only as Christians, but as human beings, is to welcome people, to protect them, to promote them, and to integrate them.
A cardinal in charge of migration and human development at the Vatican speaks his mind. Next, we talk to EWTN's senior Vatican analyst about the unusual nature of the Vatican's outspokenness and look at the Pope's relationship with the U.S.
There was not much speaking to the female experience of sexual brokenness and addiction.
A place of honesty, hope, and healing for Catholic women struggling with sexual addiction. The story behind Magdala Ministries.
Probably means not feeding their children that night. Maybe it means they can't pay the rent, they're gonna get evicted, you know? And that's why I always would inquire, you know? Tell me a little bit what's going on in your life.
And later, you know him from his courtroom TV show. Judge Frank Caprio talks about the Catholic values that provided compassion for so many others. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
This week, before the papal letter on immigration to the American bishops was released, we heard from another high-level official at the Vatican, also making the unusual move to publicly go on the record about the Trump administration's immigration policy and the freezing of global foreign aid dispersed through USAID. Cardinal Michael Cerny leads the Vatican Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development. He says every government has the right to review its foreign aid budget, but that abruptly breaking commitments to already funded programs puts millions of lives at risk around the globe. He said it would have been more responsible to provide advanced warning because it takes time to find other ways to help vulnerable populations.
A crackdown is a terrible way to administer affairs and much less to administer justice. And so I'm very sorry that many people are being hurt and indeed terrorized by the measures. And I can only hope that the church in each place is able to help them and, if possible, even protect them.
In addition to the Vatican office responsible for migrants, Cardinal Cerny heads the church's Caritas Internationalis charity, the second largest international humanitarian aid group in the world, serving the needs of people around the globe. To talk about Vatican response to U.S. policy matters, both the Cardinal Cerny remarks and the papal letter to American bishops earlier this week, we are joined by Frank Rocha, EWTN's senior Vatican analyst. Frank, thanks for joining us. From your years reporting on the Vatican, how unusual is it to see a pope and other Vatican officials comment so explicitly on the policies of a foreign government?
Well, it's very unusual. I mean, we remember in 2003 when John Paul II opposed the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, he generally avoided specifically, explicitly mentioning the United States. He spoke against war. And we see that more recently, Pope Francis has avoided blaming Russia for the invasion of Ukraine. He doesn't speak about human rights abuses in China. And as much as the U.S. bishops would have liked it, he didn't talk about abortion specifically during the Biden administration. So it's very unusual, yes.
And Frank, Cardinal Cerny expressed deep concern about the damage freezing foreign aid from USAID would have around the globe. But in an appearance on Fox News, the vice president, J.D. Vance, used his interpretation of Catholic doctrine from St. Augustine to justify the administration's America First policy. Here's what he said.
There's this old school, and I think it's a very Christian concept, by the way, that you love your family, and then you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in your own country, and then, after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world.
Vance there was trying to describe St. Augustine's concept of Ordo Amoris, or the order of love. Without referencing Vance by name in his letter to American bishops this week, Pope Francis wrote essentially that Vance did not understand that aspect of Catholic Church teaching. He said, "Christian love is not a concentric expansion of interest that little by little extend to other persons and groups. The true Ordo Amoris that must be promoted is that which we discover by meditating constantly on the parable of the Good Samaritan, that is, by meditating on the love that builds a fraternity open to all without exception." And Frank, what do you make of this back and forth over Ordo Amoris and the controversy it created?
Well, from one point of view, the Catholic Church ought to be very happy that there's a big public policy debate being conducted in the terms of medieval theology. I mean, that's very. And what's interesting, too, is that what people weren't. This was happening a lot on Twitter or X, and people weren't firing back and saying, you know, just keep religion out of it. What does that have to do with it? They were citing chapter and verse, saying, well, no, the gospel says this or that. So it was a theological debate about public policy in the United States. I think in another sense, though, it was a bit of a rabbit hole because, and not to the advantage of the people who are criticizing Vance, because the implication, if it wasn't the intention of the people who were hitting back at Vance, was that, well, in fact, we don't have a priority responsibility for the people closest to us, that we should treat everybody equal, even people who live in other countries. And I don't think that's what they meant to say. But in any case, politically, it's a losing argument. No one's going to go for that. So I think Bishop Seitz of El Paso, Texas, had it right. He was on a podcast, a Dispatch podcast, and he said, yes, we have an immediate responsibility for the people closest to us, but that doesn't mean we can ignore other people. That would have been the way to get around it. But instead, for some reason, people want, and the Pope himself left that impression, that he wanted to contest the idea that we have more responsibility for our family and than our immediate neighbors.
And Frank, one thing we know for sure, Catholic Church teaching isn't guided or rooted in different political policies as they change. Just where do you see these public disagreements headed into the future?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think what has to happen is, I mean, it's one thing to say meditate on the parable of the Good Samaritan, sure, but people are going to reach very different conclusions when it comes to policy, is to be more concrete. And that's difficult because, I mean, Cardinal Czerny, whom you quoted earlier in that same interview with the Associated Press, he said, well, only really Lebanon it has reached the limit or exceeded the limit of the amount of number of immigrants it can take, and maybe a couple other places. Now, Lebanon has about the number of refugees in Lebanon is about 60% of its population and citizenship. I mean, if the United States were even to approach that, we would be talking about tens and tens of millions of people more, maybe more than 100 million people coming in. So that's not politically very viable. I think, on the other hand, if you just keep it on the level of piety or good intentions, then people are going to reach very different conclusions, and it's not clear what kind of guidance the church is giving.
And we'll keep paying attention to these developments. But before we let you go, can you give us an update on the Pope's health? He was admitted to the hospital with bronchitis on Friday. What can you tell us, Frank?
That's right. Well, he's canceled all his appointments through Monday. He's in the hospital. And as we speak in the early evening Rome time, the Vatican recently issued an update and said that he has a respiratory tract infection. He's taking drugs. They didn't specify which as part of his therapy in the hospital, and that his condition is stable. So the Pope frequently has respiratory problems this time of year. And he did last year. And then he bounced back and took a marathon trip to Asia. And in the late summer. But right now, that's the situation as we speak.
Well, we'll keep him in prayers. Frank Rocha, EWTN Senior Vatican Analyst, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Headlines are next in the Week in Review.
I feel like the luckiest man on earth right now. I want you to know that I am not a hero in this at all. And President Trump is a hero.
I think this could be the very important element. You could be a big part of it, actually, because it could be a big, important part of getting the war over with Ukraine.
After years of imprisonment and countless prayers, an American walks free. The schoolteacher and devout Catholic was welcomed to the White House as soon as he touched down in the U.S., after his negotiated release from Russia. Expressing his gratitude to Russian President Vladimir Putin, President Trump says the exchange could be a turning point in Russia's ongoing war with Ukraine. Mark Fogel's release and how it might play into Russia's war with Ukraine tops the Week in Review. The 63-year-old spent more than 3 years in Russian custody, just a fraction of the 14-year sentence he was expected to serve. A history teacher at this prestigious American embassy school, Fogel was sentenced to hard labor for flying into Moscow with medically prescribed marijuana. Special envoy Steve Witkoff visited Moscow earlier this week for talks with senior Russian officials. And while there, Witkoff negotiated Fogel's return home and flew back with him Tuesday night. Fogel's 95-year-old mother prayed the rosary each night for his return. She told EWTN News Nightly about the importance of her family's faith through her son's detainment.
He has been going to some kind of a little church building that is on the premises, and he was able to walk there every day, and he said he walked there a couple times a day, and it gave him a lot of comfort because he felt like there was only an altar there, no seats, just an altar, but he said he stood in front of that altar and prayed every day, and our faith has really helped us through this whole ordeal. And we thank God for that.
In exchange for Fogel, the U.S. released Russian cyber kingpin Alexander Vinnik, who ran one of the world's largest cryptocurrency exchanges. The Justice Department says Vinnik laundered billions of dollars through his exchange and supported the work of hackers, drug traffickers, and identity thieves. Calling the prisoner swap a thaw in U.S.-Russian relations, President Trump said he had a long call with President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday and announced they had agreed to begin negotiations on ending the war with Ukraine. The president said he and Putin would meet soon in Saudi Arabia without Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky, intensifying long-held fears that Ukraine would be excluded from peace talks to determine its own future. Upending 3 years of U.S. policy towards Ukraine, The announcement made no mention of Europe, playing into European leaders' fears that their defense interests will also fall by the wayside if Trump sidelines them in talks with Putin. The reaction in Moscow to the call was practically gleeful. State-backed media struck a triumphant tone, saying the U.S. finally hurt Zelensky for real. A pro-Kremlin tabloid went further, publishing a column with the headline, "Trump signed Zelensky's death sentence." In Ukraine, many were horrified by the Trump-Putin call amid mounting fears the U.S. is about to sell them out. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appears increasingly frustrated and concerned, insisting Ukraine must be at the negotiating table.
Today, the main thing is that everything does not go according to Putin's plan. He wants to do everything so that he has bilateral talks with the United States of America. We cannot accept it. As an independent country, any agreements made without us, I articulate this very clearly to our partners, any bilateral negotiations about Ukraine, not on other topics, but any bilateral talks about Ukraine without us, we will not accept.
In the meantime, in his first overseas trip as defense secretary during comments at NATO headquarters, Pete Hegseth further alarmed Ukraine and European allies by publicly ruling out Ukrainian membership in NATO. Hegseth also said Ukraine returning to its pre-war 2014 borders would be unrealistic, effectively suggesting Ukraine cede territory to Russia. It was a striking reversal of U.S. and NATO's previous position and widely perceived as weakening Ukraine's negotiating position. In a pivotal moment for U.S. relations with the Middle East, Trump and the King of Jordan met at the White House earlier this week. Their conversation centered around the future of the Gaza Strip. During his meeting with King Abdullah II, Trump doubled down on his plan to force Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip to other Middle Eastern nations and develop the Strip into premium housing. His proposal has gained ire from both Arab leaders and those living in Gaza. In front of reporters, he insisted the U.S. has the authority to take over the Gaza Strip, even suggesting the U.S. could cut off aid to Jordan and Egypt if they don't go along with his plan. Abdullah, though, visibly uncomfortable with the president's proposal, did not outright reject his idea.
We're not going to buy anything. We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it. And we're going to run it very properly.
We have to look at the best interests of the United States, of the people in the region, especially to my people of Jordan. And we're going to have some interesting discussions today. I think
after his meeting at the White House, Abdullah firmly stated his opposition to Trump's plan. Writing on social media, "I reiterated Jordan's steadfast position against the displacement of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the unified Arab position. Rebuilding Gaza without displacing the Palestinians and addressing the dire humanitarian situation should be the priority for all." Hamas claims it will release three more hostages this weekend as scheduled. That comes just days after it threatened to withhold their release indefinitely, putting an already shaky ceasefire with Israel in jeopardy. Hamas accused Israel of violating the terms of the ceasefire on Monday, alleging it failed to remove Israeli soldiers from Gaza and delivering promised aid. In response, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Israel would end the ceasefire if hostages were not released by Saturday. Just weeks into this first phase of the ceasefire, both Hamas and Israel have claimed the other side has broken the truce. But these recent accusations sparked a new level of tension. For the family members of those still held hostage, every possible delay or ceasefire dispute deepens fears that their loved ones might not return home alive.
Every kind of message like that is a shock. We're trying to analyze it. We're trying to think, what are the possibilities? Is this kind of a psychological terrorist that they're pulling on us?
Out of some 250 people initially abducted, the bodies of 45 dead hostages have been recovered, and 138 live hostages have been rescued or freed. That includes 21 hostages exchanged for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners during the current ceasefire. An update now on the Trump administration's efforts to shrink the federal workforce. Just 77,000 workers chose to accept the voluntary buyout offer presented by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, far fewer than hoped for. So on Thursday, the Trump administration ordered mass firings across agencies for probationary employees who have not been employed long enough to gain civil service protections, potentially affecting hundreds of thousands of civil servants. Among those agencies impacted, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is losing one-tenth of its workforce, and the Energy Department will lose some 300 workers responsible for the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. The president of the American Federation of Government Employees says agencies have spent years recruiting and developing the next generation of public servants, and that the very talent needed to run agencies is being thrown away. Longtime Trump advisor Steve Bannon pleaded guilty this week to defrauding donors who gave money to build a wall along the southern border. Prosecutors say Bannon and others raised millions through a fundraiser called Build the Wall and falsely told donors that money would not be used to pay the salary of one of its founders. In exchange for pleading guilty to a felony, Bannon will get no prison time and will not have to pay restitution. This is the second time Bannon has avoided trial in this case. A top prosecutor for one of the most prestigious federal courts in the nation has resigned after refusing a demand from the Trump Justice Department that she ask a judge to drop corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Danielle Sassoon, the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, announced her resignation on Thursday. In a letter, she told U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi that she could not in good faith ask a judge to drop the charges because the law did not support a dismissal. She added she was confident beyond a reasonable doubt that Adams committed the bribery and fraud he was indicted for last year. Sassoon belongs to the Conservative Federalist Society and is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The new team at the Justice Department says they wanted Adams free of the charges in exchange for his cooperation on the Trump immigration enforcement efforts in New York City. And now, an update to our Bishop's wager from last week. The Eagles clinched the championship from the Chiefs at the Super Bowl, which means the Diocese of Kansas City-St. Joseph owes their friends at the Archdiocese of Philadelphia a gift. As promised on our program last week, Bishop James Johnson of Kansas City-St. Joseph will send Archbishop Nelson Perez and the Archdiocese of Philadelphia not just some classic Kansas City barbecue, but a $500 donation. That money will go to Catholic Social Services Philadelphia and will help them in their mission to provide housing, support, and care to those who need it most. On social media, the staff there shared photos with those they serve, showing off their team spirit and celebrating their win. But no matter the outcome of the Super Bowl, the Bishop's wager is always a win because it supports those who help our most vulnerable neighbors. We'll be right back.
I get to work with women who are setting their hearts and their sights on heaven, and that we're all going to get there together.
Next, the difficult subject of porn addiction. We talk to the founder of a Catholic ministry designed to help those who can find help nowhere else.
Last week, we reported on a case the Supreme Court centered around a Texas law that aims to protect minors from accessing pornography. It's the first time the Supreme Court has looked at the issue of porn in more than 20 years. But behind that legal battle to curb access is a spiritual battle, one that thousands of men and women suffering from sexual addiction must fight every day. Pornography has largely been considered a guy issue, and many resources are specifically geared towards men. But many women also struggle with porn addiction and may not find the same resources or support. That's where Magdala Ministries comes in. It's an apostolate specifically designed to help women find support and healing from sexual addiction. Since its founding in 2021, Magdala has reached women through small groups in more than 20 college campuses in more than 40 countries. Founder Rachel Kalacki recently sat down with Armance Alvarado to discuss the story of Magdala Ministries and her own testimony of recovering from porn addiction.
Rachel, thank you so much for being with us. Tell me, what is the background of Magdala and what you do there?
Yeah, Magdala is an organization that offers community and resources to women struggling with sexual addiction. So there's a lot that can come under that umbrella, but it's primarily addiction to pornography or other sexually compulsive behaviors. So we run virtual groups, and we also partner with college campuses and parishes to run groups in person.
When you think about sexual addiction, immediately the caricature that people see in their heads is of men.
Yeah.
They think of men all of the time. They would never imagine that women, the way that they're made, beautifully formed, would have these struggles as well. Was that also something that surprised you when you started advocacy? Was there a resistance to you bringing this forward?
Yes, there was and there still is. That's probably our biggest obstacle, is people being unwilling to admit that women might struggle too. And there's been several reasons why that I've encountered, I think the primary one is actually from men being afraid that if women are also struggling, who's going to help them? I've actually had many men like say that to me. Rather than seeing this as a joint effort of both men and women trying together to become whole, I think men have been taught to rely on the purity of women for a little too long. So there's definitely some resistance there. I wasn't surprised. I think we're all sexual beings. We all need to bring that under alignment with God's will. But it's been taking a little while to overcome that criticism, for sure.
When you think of root causes, what would the root causes be? What would you identify as the root causes for this rise among women for both pornography addiction and just sexual addiction in general?
Trauma, childhood trauma. Most of our women experience some form of abuse or neglect, varying levels of gravity, but I think that's the biggest tie, is just some form of emotional, physical, sexual trauma. We work out a lot of our traumatic experiences in compulsive behaviors, so it makes a lot of sense that if women are experiencing higher rates of trauma, I think the data suggests that at least one in four women are victims of abuse before they turn 18, abuse or assault. It makes sense that they would be finding a place to work that out. So they're trying to make sense of what they've been through, essentially.
What does restorative healing look like? What does it look like when a woman completes that program, gets the help that she needs, and confidently enters the world understanding who she was made to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think recovery is not like quantitative, like a lot of people want it to be. Like, I think they want us to have metrics of this is how many women come out in long-term sobriety, this is how long it lasts. What we measure success on in Magdala is how intimately are women walking with the Lord when they come out of our program? How confident are they that His mercy is enough for them? How much are they engaged with the sacramental life of the church? Are they continually repenting? Are they seeking the help that they need? We care far more about the metric of like intimacy with Christ than sobriety. And ironically, out of intimacy with Christ comes more sobriety. So that's kind of our first fruits mentality. I think wholeness is not, we can't accomplish it on earth. Like, I think that's something that's complete in heaven. So I think women and men, I think we go into these programs wanting this stamp that like we're never going to struggle ever again, we're never going to feel broken ever again, and that's just not possible. So I think we also want people to leave with a sense of hope that no matter what layer of woundedness they encounter in themselves, that Jesus is going to be enough. He's going to pull them through it just like He's pulled them through every other step.
There's a Supreme Court case that is going to look at age verification for access to pornography. Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know, experiencing the reality of the people coming to you asking for help, how important are those measures?
Extremely important. They need to be very thorough, though. Like, age verification in the past has been very easy to bypass. I bypassed it as an adolescent. So I think if they're going to do it, it needs to be real. But if we can keep exposure from happening at the young ages that it already is, I think it would save people a lot of trouble. By the time women come to us, our largest age group is in their 20s. They're sometimes 10, 15 years deep into an addiction. So if they're just seeking help a decade in, that puts a lot more pressure on us. That's a lot of work. Whereas if we're just encountering people who are a year or two deep, it might be a little easier to extract them from the harmful behavior.
And is the access to devices, is the age, a lot of people think that access to pornography hasn't changed. Well, before you would go somewhere in the, you know, cover of night to get a video, whereas now it's accessible on your phone. Is it really different? Has that dynamic actually changed?
Yes. The ability to be anonymous online has completely changed porn access. And I think it's changed it primarily for women. So I think when porn was accessible only in the clandestine kind of settings that you're talking about, men were far more likely to engage with it. But I think when the porn industry got access to streaming and just the, you know, the world of the internet, there's far, far, far more content on the internet than people want to believe. It's everywhere. It's geared towards men, geared towards women. It has no limits. So I think streaming, I think smartphones, like, it's constant access. I'd like to say that having a smartphone in your back pocket as a porn addict is the equivalent of having a beer in your back pocket as an alcoholic. Like, you have access to the harmful substance constantly with you. So willpower has no stand against something like that. So I'm definitely an advocate for digital minimalism, especially in recovery, but even beyond, even for your own mental health.
When you started working and saw this You came into it through your own personal experience, and you have a beautiful testimony that you share very courageously with others. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us why you thought you needed help and restoration?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So my story involves porn use from the ages of 13 to 19. So I had 6 years of use. And it was very hard to admit to myself that that's what was happening, because in my mind, only men watched porn. So whatever I was doing couldn't possibly be that, right? And so I minimized it for a long time because of the messaging in culture, but also in the church. And I think when I became an adult and I entered long-term sobriety and I encountered more and more of my friends with similar stories or who were in the midst of consumption, I just wanted to create the resources that I needed, that I would have wanted at the time. And that's kind of how Magdala was born. So I don't think I ever had a moment where I really saw, like, okay, this is, I'm going to share now, like, this is what I'm going to do. It just kind of was one open door after another, and more people have just needed it. So I think I've just shared through each open door. But Magdala was mostly based in, like, what did my heart need to hear from the church when I was struggling? And how can I be that voice now? How can my team be that voice now? And the beautiful thing is when you're creating a community, like an organization that's based in community, you're joined by many, many voices very quickly. So I think courage is one of our organizational values, and it's been amazing to see how many moderators and participants from our groups are now sharing their testimonies and their stories in their communities and circles. So I think the narrative is switching with this kind of grassroots effort, but it's mostly based on the bravery of like a whole collective of women, not just one.
I love it. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
To learn more about this ministry or how you can find hope and healing from sexual addiction, go to magdalaministries.org. There you can find more information about small groups, listen to podcasts, and discover other valuable resources. Next, the life and times of a famous Catholic jurist, a conversation with Judge Frank Caprio.
Just trying to be decent with everyone. I never sat on the bench and thought that I was above anybody else.
How the judge's Catholic faith impacted his court rulings, right after this.
Empathy, compassion, and kindness in the courtroom. Millions of people saw those qualities when they watched Judge Frank Caprio on his courtroom television program, dispensing justice from the bench. Admired by viewers across the country, the now retired judge is a devout Catholic who is always leaning on his faith. Judge Caprio spoke to our Colin Flynn in Miami.
Judge Frank Caprio has become known as the judge with the big heart.
I'm not going to charge you anything for the ticket.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Touching millions of people online with his acts of mercy and compassion.
If you can give me some time to pay it up, I'll pay it.
The case is dismissed. We appreciate your service in Vietnam. Thank you for your service, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Retired now, he was a judge for almost 40 years.
Judge Frank Caprio, it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking.
Although living a life of luxury today, his childhood could not have been more different.
I had the most privileged childhood I could imagine. I had the privilege of being brought up poor. My dad was an immigrant from Italy. And we were living in what they call a cold water flat, which meant we didn't have hot running water. And I remember I probably was 10, 12 years old. And for some reason, one day, he put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, someday you're going to be a lawyer. He says, and you can't charge poor people like us. And that had such an impact on me. I never wanted to be anything else in the world except an attorney.
Frank listened to his father, went to law school, and passed the bar in 1965, and then became a judge in 1985.
Because you're in a position of power, doesn't mean you have to use it against the people who don't have power. Mm. I think you have to, it's a balance, and that's why I always would inquire, you know. Tell me a little bit what's going on in your life.
Where do you go to school?
Roger Williams.
What are you studying?
Engineering and math.
Frank Caprio became known as the judge who, even if you had broken the law,
I just realized a light later than I should have. So
he would listen and take your circumstances into account.
the fact that you're a student, you know, and the fact that you got all these A's, I'm going to reward you for that, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
When you started to become known as a compassionate judge, did you worry, Frank, about what will my colleagues think? Will they think I'm a weak judge in the system, that I'm not delivering the law of the
land? I never worried a second about it.
Didn't care.
And I know that many of them have expressed to me, you know, how could you be so lenient? You know, how could you be so lenient? Mm. It's very simple. I just placed myself in the shoes of the person before me. And compassion is a very, very strong trait.
By simply asking people about their stories, Frank Caprio got a glimpse into the lives of so many, a masterclass in human nature.
I dealt with a domestic violence relationship. I ate a lot of those weights, running away from somebody that used to chase me with my daughter.
And the fact that a powerful judge was showing such compassion made for beautiful moments.
I'm sorry. I understand. I am live here in 3 years.
Well, welcome to America.
Another wonderful moment when the man was given a ticket, but his wife came in and said, "My name's on that."
I got the ticket. He was driving my car.
I didn't do it.
I'm not guilty.
He did it.
He did it.
He did it.
He is.
And I said to him, "Do you put up with this every day?" He said, "Yes."
"You go through this every day?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
"We've been happily married for 43 years, right?"
"Yes, dear."
That is dismissed.
But out of all the cases over the years, there is one which stands out in Frank's mind. The moment a 96-year-old came into the court with an unpaid speeding ticket. The first one ever in his life.
Gentleman came in, he was in his 90s, charged with speeding.
"I'm 96 years old and I drive slowly and I only drive when I have to. I was going to the blood work for my boy, he's handicapped."
"You were taking your son to the doctor's office?"
"Yeah, I take him for blood work every 2 weeks."
"Well, how old is your son?"
63.
"Yeah.
He's got cancer."
"You are a good man. I wish you all the best. I wish the best for your son, and I wish you good health, and your case is dismissed. Good luck to you, and God bless you."
"Thank you."
I dismissed the case, obviously, and we became very friendly with Victor. Actually helped Victor celebrate his 100th birthday. We had a big party for him.
That's fantastic. Do you miss the courtroom?
I do. I do miss the courtroom. I had a long run. When somebody comes in and they think the world is ending because of their issue, and I was able to help them and then see the relief in their eye, you know, and so I miss that. I miss helping people. You know, I keep repeating these words, but compassion and understanding, compassion. And understanding.
Today, Judge Caprio is 88 and has just published a book entitled Compassion in the Courtroom, where he says his message is simple. Be kind to others, be slow to judge, and always show mercy. In Miami, Florida, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
Case is dismissed.
Thank you, Leon.
Good luck.
What a beautiful story. And there is much more to Colm's conversation with Judge Caprio. You can see the extended interview on the EWTN YouTube page. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Mark Irons. Join us again, same time next week, for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. We hope to see you then.